Okay, my name is Kate Roller, and I'm with the Southern Plains Climate Hub at the ARS Grazing Lands Research Lab. And today I'm going to be talking to you about how managing for soil health impacts a suite of soil health indicators in cropping systems across the Southern Plains. So I'll start with a little bit of climate and weather and cropping background for the Southern Plains. The Southern Plains system is probably best defined by its variability. So this variability can occur both interannually in terms of cycles of wet and dry periods, as well as intraannually with events like extreme weather or flash droughts, fires, floods, you name it, we've got it. What you see in this graph, oh dear. Okay, there we go. What you see in this graph here is example of that interannual variability. You have these wet periods shown by the long blue lines, which are a sudden jump from a dry year to a wet year. And then you have these periods of normal or below normal precipitation. These two maps show the two gradients for which the Great Plains are known and make such good climate study systems. So from the east to west, we have a pretty solid precipitation gradient all the way from approximately 1,600 centimeters a year to only 160 centimeters a year. And then from north to south, we have a temperature gradient from approximately 10.4 degrees Celsius mean annual temperature to approximately 24 degrees Celsius mean annual temperature in the south. In terms of soil health management, you might imagine that since we have those massively different climatic conditions, we have a lot of different farming practices. However, one that's been catching on in probably the last 10 years, certainly, if not before that, has been just the general idea of soil health management. A lot of this is no-till. So, for example, there are approximately 69 million acres of cropland in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas, according to the last agricultural census. Of those, about 15 million acres are strictly no-till, and an additional approximately 11 million acres are conservation tillage, so not strictly no-till, but they're trying to reduce the amount that they till, either by using strip till or just tilling less often, something like that. And what you see along the bottom here is an example of a no-till field. So this is soybeans planted into wheat. And then they also are starting to use cover crops more commonly. So this is a popular cover crop that I took a picture of in Kansas. It's red clover. And it was really popular in the fields up there. We didn't have as much of that in the Oklahoma and Texas fields. And we know that employing these soil health management practices, especially no-till, can affect the percent of organic carbon, especially in the upper 10 to 15 centimeters of soil. So this paper back in 1997 in a continuous wheat system showed that in the upper 10, 15 centimeters, no-till significantly increased the amount of percent organic carbon in the soil. Our question for this study is, how does climate affect the degree of difference in soil health between the soil health managed fields and conventionally managed fields across the whole Southern Plains? We predicted that the differences would be most pronounced in the eastern sites that receive the high amounts of yearly precipitation, primarily because that's where the carbon and soil organic matter is going to build the fastest. We set up 12 sites, which you can just about see here in green stars, all the way from northern Kansas to kind of northern Texas, southern Oklahoma, all in non-irrigated systems, with the exception of one. And each individual location had three pairs of fields. each pair was a soil health managed field, and then usually right across the fence or right across the road, a conventionally managed field, so that we could try to stay on the same soil type and certainly within the same kind of microenvironment. We took three sets of samples on each field, and each of these sample sets had 10 narrow cores for that we're looking at for microbial communities, and then two larger cores, which we're using for bulk density as well as all the other indicators that we're looking at. We sampled from 0 to 5 centimeters, 5 to 10 centimeters, and 10 to 15 centimeters, and that was to get an idea of if it changes within that depth. The soil health indicators that we tested, we chose microbial community structure for the biological characteristic, and we're getting at that through phospholipid fatty acid analysis, which I am currently doing at the lab. We also looked at bulk density and soil texture for physical characteristics, and then for chemical characteristics, we have nitrogen, so good it's on there twice, phosphorus, phosphorus, potassium, percent soil organic matter, percent carbon, and ammonium. With the exception of the microbial community structure and bulk density, which I did or am doing at our lab, all the rest of this was done at the Oklahoma State University Soil Testing Lab. And we have some preliminary results. So regarding our prediction that the differences would be most pronounced in the eastern sites that receive those high amounts of yearly precipitation, you can see on this graph that there is a huge amount of variation. Along the x-axis, we have the three depth increments, 5, 10, and 15, corresponding to 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and 10 to 15. And then along the y-axis, we have the difference in percent organic matter. So what you need to know, it's conventional management minus soil health management. So if the percent organic matter was higher on the soil health managed field, the number will be negative, so down on this side. If there was more on the conventionally managed field, it'll be a positive number. And you can see that there may be something to that prediction in that the differences between fields look greater for the eastern sites, which are these ones in red. I mentioned a site that had irrigation. We didn't find out until we got out there that the guy irrigated his fields, and so we took samples anyway and noted it. As you might imagine, his field is like this weird outlier. That could be what's going on with Weber's Falls. All of this basically to say that none of this is statistically significant. turns out when you have 12 sites and a lot of variation, you get p-values that are ridiculous. However, if you take all of those eastern sites and combine them and take all the western sites and combine them, you see a fairly decent difference between eastern and western. And I think there may be something to that, even though it's not statistically significant. And I will get to that in a moment in the discussion. So I think part of what's contributing to get towards the discussion in this statistical significance problem is the high natural variation in soils. So even within one field in Kansas, you can have like 10 different kinds of soils. There's also pretty high human or management-induced variation, and that's because we're not working on experimental fields. We're actually working on farmers' fields. So they've managed the way they've managed, and they can tell us what those management choices were and when they made them, but we can't just say, you know, this field has never been tilled, or it's been tilled for exactly 10 years. We pretty much had to use what we have. So I think that variation is in there as well. And part of that comes down to soil health management not being rigidly defined. So what works as soil health management for a farmer in Kansas is not probably going to necessarily work for soil health management for a farmer in Texas. You can grow cover crops in Kansas, and you can't always in Texas. I think it's possible that the traditional statistics with p-values and t-tests and ANOVAs and that kind of thing may not be ideal for working with this kind of data set. We're going to start with those, but we actually work with a statistician at Texas A&M, and I think she may have some ideas as to how we can start teasing apart these data. I do think there are trends worth noting, however. So the decrease in difference with soil depth shows up several times. It shows up in Axtell, right here, shows up again in Parsons, Shamrock, and Bonham. And it seems to me that showing up that many times may not be random. There also does appear to be something of a larger difference between fields in the east versus fields in the west, and that may or may not hold true with those other indicators we looked at, so we need to look at those as well. Finally, you can't see it in that graph, but there was a decreased variation in the tilled conventional management soils compared to soil health managed soils, which is pretty consistent with previous research and at least tends to imply that we're doing something, that we're doing something right as the computer tries to jump off the, okay, it's all good. So I think that's something worth looking at as well, if for no other reason than kind of like a logic sanity check, we did do something right. Next steps for this, we'll be finishing those phospholipid fatty acid analyses and then looking at differences in the microbial community structure and microbial biomass between the fields. And we're going to add additional or alternate explanatory variables to, again, try to tease apart where those differences are coming from. So I want to look at actual evapotranspiration, which is sort of what you're getting at with precipitation and temperature anyway, but at least you're combining them as opposed to separating them out. We'll also want to look at the crops grown, so whether they grow continuous wheat or whether they're doing a really diverse rotation. And then also years since conversion, specifically to no-till, but also to cover crops. We know that with no-till, there's a bit of a lag time before you start seeing buildup of soil organic matter. So that's important to have in there as well. And we want to get this research out to the farmers who can use it. So we're planning on doing that through field days, as well as soil health seminars that we have at the local community college. I think the most important people actually for getting these data out are going to be the farmers themselves, because they organize their own field days and they're going to get all of these analyses back. So they'll be able to share it with neighbors and whoever else shows up to their field days. Finally, we want to contribute to this climate hub vision. So for robust and healthy agricultural production and natural resources under increasing climate variability and climate change. And we hope to do that so that farmers can make the decisions they need to make in order to keep their operations going and feed us, because we like eating food. And with that, I would like to thank all of you, as well as the numerous NRCS and ARS folks who helped me find and sample field sites, and especially the farmers who put up with a city girl coming and hanging out and asking stupid questions and digging holes in their fields. If you're interested in learning more about the climate hubs, this is my plug for my job. We have our website right there. I'm also happy to talk anyone's ear off about it after my talk. So, and I can give people my email as well. I forgot to put it on here. But with that, if I have time, I'll take questions.
I think we have time for one question.
Hooray!
Yes, anyone?
The term is knowledge transfer. That is, if you search in the internet, knowledge transfer, you take from the farmer his knowledge, mm-hmm. and return his knowledge. There's many interesting questions.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool field. I have a friend in actually the Northern Plains who does a lot of that, so we talk about the finer points of it and how to do it most effectively a lot.